everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I have a great show for all of you today. Eva Greenthal from the Center for Science and the Public Interest will be joining me and telling us more about the work of the center and what she does there. And we'll be discussing food labeling. But before she comes on, I have some things I want to share with you, things in the news, ways you can take action, and of course, my weekly recipe with all of you. First, on my newsletter this week, I wrote about, the new year approaching. First off, I just can't believe how quick time is flying by. I feel like it was just a few weeks ago that I was in the garden with my interns harvesting vegetables, and here we are with the solstice right behind us, and the shortest day of the year. Now, starting today, the days are getting longer, so that's a good thing. But New Year's is right around the corner, and for many of us, every year when the new year approaches, we think about ways that we can improve what we are doing and ways that we are and things that we'd like to add into our life. And I came across a publication that Dr. Joel Fuhrman put out. He was a guest on my show back in March 2020, and just as the pandemic was really taking hold of this country. And he is a New York Times bestselling author. He's a family practitioner, and he has been a real leader in the plant-based eating. And he's done a lot to spread his knowledge about healthy eating with so many people in the public. And he just came out with a free little publication called The 9 Foods That Supercharge Your Health. And I just thought, it would be a good thing to share with everybody that follows me, because one thing we have seen with the pandemic is that those that are healthier are able to, their immune systems are able to fight the virus much better than if you don't have a good diet. And I think, so many of us in this country are overweight, are fighting diabetes, high blood pressure, and are in line for a heart attack, cancer, all these things that we know a healthy diet really can help. And so I wanted to share with you the link to these 9 foods that supercharge your health. And you'll find that on my blog. And, think about it. Think about what you want to do in this next year in 2022 to improve your health, improve your life, make you stronger. And I just think that's a good way to start. Ways that you can take action. I had a really great conversation with the Cornucopia Institute last week about their campaign to get carrageenan out of organic foods. And I've signed so many petitions over the years to try to get carrageenan out. And, when you look up carrageenan, you'll see that it comes from red seaweed. And so one would think that, it's a natural product, but it's so highly processed that it has become a synthetic ingredient that is being added into foods, and it is allowed in organic foods. And yet it's known to cause an inflammatory reaction, especially in individuals that have irritable bowel syndrome or colitis, any type of intestinal issues. Carrageenan just wreaks havoc on their body. And we just feel like it shouldn't be in organic foods. And so the Cornucopia Institute has a great campaign, and they're asking all of us to really become active participants in this fight to get carrageenan out of organic foods. The National Organic Standards Board recently voted to keep allowing it in, and they only vote every 5 years. So it's stuck in there for 5 years. But we thought if we could pressure enough organic companies to take it out, that they could lead the way. And so in my Take Action on my newsletter, there's ways that you can take action, ways that you can let organic food companies know that you don't want carrageenan in their foods and see if they can reformulate it. Many of them are reformulating it, and it's really, you know, a worthwhile thing. I also ask everyone to, if you're in New York, to let Governor Hochul know that you want her to sign the bill that will make our drinking water safer. Right now, a lot of toxins are allowed to remain in water because they don't test for them. And this is a petition to encourage her to sign the bill that will up the regulations and the testing of water so that we can really feel comfortable that our water is safe. Because we all want to be able to drink the water that comes out of our tap and not rely on bottled water, which we know is just adding to the plastic pollution problem on so many levels. So please do that. And starting January 1st, the new GMO labeling law goes into effect. And this is a real whitewashing or greenwashing of a labeling law. Right now, everyone knows about GMOs. We've been hearing about GMOs. And instead of calling this a GMO labeling law, they call it a bioengineered labeling law. And people don't know what bioengineered foods are. If you ask somebody what is a bioengineered food, they would not necessarily know what it is. But if you ask them what a GMO food is, I'm pretty sure they will know. And there's so many loopholes in this labeling law. Companies are even allowed to just put a QR code on the package that says for more information, which we know is deceptive, and it also is discriminatory because it requires a person to have a smartphone. And we know many people can't afford a smartphone, choose not to have one, or are older and don't know how to work them. So a QR code does not tell us anything. You know, if they really want us to know what's in the food, they need to do clear labeling that says contains genetically modified foods. And they don't. So it's really just, you know, more work to keep us in the dark. And it's really so frustrating, to say the least. But anyway, I'm sure we'll be talking more about labeling with my guest when she comes on. But first, I want to share with you my recipe this week. I made a white bean and escarole soup. And as the winter comes on, you know, I just find that I crave soups and, you know, a hearty bread for dinner. That's just kind of, you know, really it. We still have salads pretty much every day for lunch, but when it comes to dinner, there's nothing like a really warm soup to just warm you up in these cold days. So the white bean escarole soup is great. The beans give you, you know, a boost of energy with the protein, and so it's really wonderful. So you can either use dried cannellini beans that you soak overnight and cook. If you cook them in a pressure cooker, they're going to cook up in like 30 minutes. So they really don't take that long. I, of course, did not plan ahead. So I used canned cannellini beans instead. I used 3 cans. And I know I say this a lot, but if you're going to use canned beans, I highly recommend purchasing Eden brand, E-D-E-N, Eden brand canned beans. They are the only ones that I am aware of that cook their beans with kombu, which is a seaweed that helps your body digest the beans better and makes you less gassy. And so that's really a wonderful thing. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you've all heard in the news that they're looking into putting seaweed into cattle feed because it will make the cows less gassy, which will help with the methane methane problem that we have from all of the livestock. So anyway, back to the recipe. So you want to start with either 1.5 cups of dried cannellini beans that you cook up or 3 cans of cannellini beans. 1 can of diced tomatoes. You can use fire roasted or just regular diced tomatoes, whichever you prefer. 1 onion chopped, 2 carrots chopped, 2 potatoes cubed, 2 and cubed small, like a half inch type size, 2 celery stalks, 4 teaspoons of salt, 2 teaspoons of pepper, 6 cloves of garlic, 10 cups of water, 4 sprigs of rosemary, 6 sprigs of thyme, 3 sprigs of oregano, 1 bay leaf, and 2 heads of escarole chopped. Now, if you don't have fresh rosemary, thyme, or oregano, you can use dried. And I would start with like a teaspoon of each of them. And then you can adjust the seasonings when you actually make the soup. You know, after it's cooked down for a while, you can adjust those spices. But you're going to start by sauteing the onions and carrots in a little bit of olive oil for about 5 minutes till they start getting soft. Add the garlic, celery, and potatoes and saute for another 5 minutes or so. Then add all the remaining ingredients. Bring it up to a boil, reduce the heat, and let it simmer for about 30 minutes until everything is soft and delicious and all the flavors meld together. Taste it, adjust the seasonings. You know, if you're on a salt-free diet, you can leave the salt out and use a salt replacement. Once everything is soft, you're going to remove about 2 cups of the soup and puree that either in a food processor, or you can actually stick an immersion blender, which is much easier, right into the pot and blend the soup up a little bit. You don't want to blend it all up. You want to see those white beans in there and you want to see the escarole in there. But just blending a little bit of it gives the broth a little bit more substance and thickness and makes it a little bit more full flavored. So that's it. You can serve it with a lemon wedge. Comes together very easily. It's delicious. And of course, if you make it, I'd love some feedback. So feel free to let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Eva Greenthal. She is the Senior Science Policy Associate at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Her work focuses on food labeling, scientific integrity, biotechnology, and lots of other things, and she'll tell us about that. Prior to joining the Center for Science in the Public Interest, Eva led a pilot evaluation of the nation's first hospital-based food pantry and worked on research initiatives related to alcohol literacy and healthy habits for young children. Before that, Eva served as a program coordinator for Let's Go at Maine Medical Center and as an AmeriCorps VISTA member at HealthReach Community Health Centers in Waterville, Maine. Eva holds a dual MS-MPH degree in food policy and applied nutrition from Tufts University and a BA in environmental studies from the University of Michigan. And talking about Tufts University, I just want to put a plug in for their listserv called Calm Food. If you are passionate about food and you really want to know what's going on in the news, Tufts University puts out this great newsletter called Calm Food, and it's just wonderful. So they also have a website called Calm Food Jobs if you're looking for a job in the food sector. So Eva, you with me?
I am. Hello, Bhavani. It's great to be here.
Hi, Eva. Welcome. So you're in Belgium right now, aren't you?
I am indeed.
That's amazing. It's amazing technology that we can be on the Zoom together while you're in Belgium and I'm here in New York. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great. I'm here for the holidays to spend some time with family, but I'm glad to be able to connect with you.
That's wonderful. So maybe you could tell my listeners first a little bit about the Center for Science in the Public Interest. When did they first form and what is their main work?
Sure. So the Center for Science in the Public Interest is a nonprofit consumer advocacy group, and we were founded in 1971 by Michael Jacobson. So we have been advocating for public health and for a healthier food system for about 50 years now. And we call ourselves America's Food and Health Watchdog because we are indeed a watchdog for both industry and government. We take no funding from the food industry, no funding from the government, because we really see ourselves as a check on the practices of both. And so today our topic is food labeling, which CSPI has been involved with for decades. We had a role in the Nutrition Labeling and Education Act of 1990, which is what established the nutrition facts label on foods. We've played a role in alcohol labeling with the Alcoholic Beverage Labeling Act of 1988. And I feel very honored to be continuing on the labeling work at CSPI.
Mm-hmm. So right now, as I mentioned in my talk, that they are starting January 1st, the bioengineered labeling law is coming into effect. Is that the same as the Food Labeling Modernization Act?
No, this is actually a very separate bill that has more to do. So the Food Labeling Modernization Act, which I think we'll be talking about for most of the time today, is a bill that's focused around making it easier for consumers to eat healthy, to select healthy foods, and increasing transparency with respect to nutrients and ingredients in foods. And the biotech labeling laws is something different that is, you know, exclusively focused around disclosure of bioengineered ingredients.
Uh-huh. And so does the Food Labeling Modernization Act label GMOs or no?
It doesn't touch on that at all, actually. It's just it deals with a wide range of issues related to food labeling, but leaves off the bioengineered component.
Uh-huh. And has the Center for Science and the Public Interest been involved at all in the GMO labeling? I know, you know, like Vermont had actually passed the first law
right,
a few years ago. I forget when that was, but it was turned over, you know, it really forced our government to turn it around.
Yeah, we have weighed in on the issue of disclosure of genetically engineered ingredients over the years, and sort of thread the needle there because, you know, the consumers are very confused about what genetic engineering means. And I think you actually mentioned in your intro, they're going to be even more confused about what bioengineered means.
Right.
Uh-huh. So it's certainly not the term we would have advocated for disclosure. And I think you also mentioned that the QR code is going to be an option and likely the one that the most companies will use, where they don't actually have to disclose with the symbol or text on the package that the product has bioengineered ingredients. They can just send consumers to a QR code to a website where in some small print somewhere on the website, it mentions that there are bioengineered ingredients. So right. It's certainly not a model for transparency.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about the current food labeling that we have now and why it needs some modernization, right? So right now we do have food labels. What's going to be different about the new Food Labeling Modernization Act?
Yeah. So We do have some requirements for food labels, and I mentioned the Nutrition Facts Panel, which is on all packaged foods since the 90s. But there are a few things that have changed in the world since that law was passed in 1990. A major one is that people are shopping for food online and in very different types of settings than they were before, and the existing legislation does not have any requirements for what needs to be disclosed for foods sold online. It's only governs the physical food package, and we need to have the information about what's in our food when we're purchasing it, not just once we get it. And so that is one issue that the new law we're working on will address. But also over the last few decades, the food industry has gotten very creative with ways to influence consumer choices. And unfortunately, that's often in the wrong direction and sort of drawing consumers towards junk foods with misleading messages, often claims on food packages that make foods seem healthier than they actually are. And so that's a major thing that the Food Labeling Modernization Act is aiming to address, because at the same time, there are rising levels of diseases that are linked to diet, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, obesity. And in order to quell the rise of those diseases, we really need a food environment that makes it easier to make healthy choices at the store.
Yeah. You know, they have really marketed and figured out that people are so so gullible that, you know, you just put something across the top of the front of a package and people believe it, you know, healthy choice, or, you know, you put a heart, healthy heart symbol there, or, you know, it says no, gluten-free, you know, that's a big one right now. I mean, I saw a sign that actually said gluten-free, buy some vegetables. I think it was in front of like the broccoli, gluten-free. It's like, you know, they're just doing anything they can to try to market things. And maybe we can talk about the front of package nutrition labeling and how this act might improve that. Because right now, like I said, you know, they just can put anything on the front of the package and people will believe it.
Right. So the what we call front of package labeling is really the centerpiece of this piece of legislation. And when we say front of package labeling, what we're really referring to is a type of label that takes key information from the nutrition facts label, which tends to be a bit complex and requires some numeracy skills, nutrition literacy skills to interpret and read and figure out how healthy a food really is. And front of package nutrition labels summarize that information in a way that is very quick and easy to understand and use to compare the healthfulness of different foods. And these front of package systems often use colors and shapes and symbols, things like that, to make them more accessible. They also, obviously by the name, they're on the front of the package, whereas the nutrition facts panel is usually on the back or the side. And that's important because the front of the package is the prime real estate for any information about the product. And people tend to rely primarily on claims that are made on the front of the package. And currently those are marketing claims. Like you mentioned, maybe it says gluten-free or all natural, low fat, of course, all of that. And so we want some factual information to about the healthfulness of the product to sort of counterbalance the marketing information.
Mm-hmm. And where is this labeling act now in its process of getting passed?
So the bill has been introduced in both the House and the Senate, and it is sponsored by a number of legislators, including it was introduced by Congressman Pallone, who is the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which is fantastic because that means that he is in a key decision-making role to decide whether the lawmakers should take a vote on the bill. And currently we're working on gaining more support in his committee for the bill so that he will be so moved to bring it to a vote hopefully in the coming months.
Uh-huh. And how will that, how will this law really affect the online shopping? Like, I know you said so many people shop online. I mean, usually if I shop online, there are little pictures that show like the side panel that you can see the ingredients. That's not always available?
It's not always available right now because it's not required. It's true that a lot of online retailers are putting that information up, which is great. That's voluntary and we're glad they're doing it. But because it's not required by law, that information is sometimes not available. Sometimes it's available, but it's inaccurate, which is a major problem because we need to be able to trust that information, of course. Sometimes it's outdated. So I've noticed a lot of products online have the old version of the nutrition facts panel, which doesn't include the line for added sugars. And, you know, we CSPI worked really hard and many advocates for nutrition worked really hard to have the nutrition facts panel updated to include that information so you know how much of the sugars in a product are added. And so we want to make sure that the nutrition information that's online is in the correct format with all of the disclosures that people need to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that we saw in the school lunch programs is that when they were cutting out, the fat, they were adding a lot of sugar in order to not compromise the flavor, right? So so they might have been taking out the fat, but they were putting in more sugar. How can we help people really understand the nutrition labels? I mean, right now, you know, you look at it and, you know, there's what's the difference between added sugar as opposed to sugar that's already, you know, naturally in the product? And is that, you know, of course, you'd assume that's worse. But a lot of times, you know, if something's just, you know, fruit juice concentrate, that still can have a lot of sugar in it.
Mm-hmm. So back to front of package nutrition labeling. It's really a goal of these systems to help people understand the healthfulness and at times the unhealthfulness of foods. So one type, just to make a paint a clearer picture, are front of package warning labels, nutrient warning labels. And these are in place in several countries, primarily in Latin America. One of those countries is Chile, where they have a label. It's a, I think, octagon shape. It's a black octagon. And in white letters, it says alto en azúcar, or high in sugar, or it might say high in saturated fat, high in sodium. And that is such a clear message that this product is high in this ingredient. And I think, you know, you see it on a lot of sweets, and you might expect it in the sweets types of foods. But a lot of people don't realize that ketchup is high in sugar, or certain salad dressings are high in sugar. And there are alternatives that won't have the label because they don't have the added sugars. So I think really simple, straightforward labeling like that can help people understand which foods to select better. And then it has a secondary outcome of actually influencing not just consumer behavior, but also industry behavior. So in Chile, one thing that they have found after evaluating their labeling law, which went into place in 2016, is that the level of sugar in the food supply has decreased significantly based on, you know, the research and this, even the statistical tests. The food industry is reformulating their food, taking out some of the sugars to avoid having to put the label on that says high in sugar. And that's a really positive outcome because it doesn't even require the individual consumer to change their behaviors. It's happening in the environment, and everyone is likely to consume less sugar as a result.
Mm-hmm. In this country, what I've seen is the food industry has such power, labeling law, you know, lobbying people, and put so much money into that. I know when Michelle Obama, you know, pushed through, you know, getting French fries and pizza out of the school lunch program, it was the frozen French fry lobbyists and the frozen pizza lobbyists that reversed that ruling. So, do you really, really think in this country that they are going to stand by and allow a law to be passed that requires them to say high in sugar or high in fat on the front of a package?
It's true that the food industry lobby is strong, but they're actually not only strong in the United States. They lobbied very hard against these policies that ended up getting passed by the lawmakers in Chile and in other Latin American countries and Israel and in several other countries. There are dozens of countries at this point that have front of package labeling laws, despite every attempt by the food industry to prevent them. So I see it more as just a matter of time before the US really has to catch up with other countries. I would have loved to see us lead, but at least at this point, we have so much scientific evidence of the impactfulness of these labels in other countries in influencing the health of the food supply and of the population. I think once the evidence really amounts and can be presented to lawmakers and to the FDA, it's really hard to argue with, and it'll be, you know, harder and harder for the food industry to make the case against labeling that really will improve population health.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. So the dietary guidelines for Americans recommend making at least half of your grains whole grains. I know, again, going back to the school lunch program, since I've been so involved in that, you know, right now during COVID, they've, you know, aborted all of those rules. You know, they really require the school lunch program to be using whole grains, and they're using the excuse of, you know, not being able to get the products as a reason to abort that. But how do you see consumers using food labeling to follow this advice?
Well, currently it is very hard to tell if a product will supply you with a lot of whole grains in your diet and help you meet that dietary guideline recommendation of making half your grains whole grains. I know a lot of people look at the fiber content of foods. You can also look at the ingredients, but the food industry has so many tricks to make people think they're getting whole grains when they're not. And they use terms like multigrain, which is an unregulated term. It really doesn't mean anything. You see a lot of made with whole grain, which, you know, a product could be made with a tiny amount of whole grain, and you know, the made with is small and the whole grain is large, and you think it's a whole grain product. We've even seen some companies doing things as, you know, almost nefarious as coloring their breads with molasses to make them look a little bit darker and hardier, when really it's just white bread. It's refined grain. So what we think would really help people select foods that are higher in whole grain content is labeling that has the percentage of the total grains in the product that are whole grained versus refined. And that's what the Food Labeling Modernization Act would require. If a food makes a claim like multigrain, made with whole grain, wheat, then it has to have a percentage disclosure.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that would be certainly helpful. You know, I have a question for you, and I don't know if you know the answer, but I know people have been asking me. You know, when for years we've all believed that brown rice is, of course, a better choice than white rice because it's a whole grain. And yet, with all the stats coming out about arsenic in rice, it turns out brown rice has more arsenic in it than white rice. Which is a better choice? I mean, that's confusing even for me.
That isn't something I've looked into a great deal. It's an interesting question. I think, you know, I guess it makes sense that white rice being so heavily processed and having the outer, I forget the specific names of the parts of the kernel, but the outer kernel removed, that's what makes it a refined grain. But the outer part of the kernel is probably what has the arsenic from the soil in it. Very complicated. And it's really, it's hard to compare because it's a completely different health issue that you're looking at, the effects of arsenic on, I don't even know exactly what health problems are linked to, you know, low levels of chronic arsenic exposure. But then with whole grains, we know that, you know, increased consumption of whole grains is cancer preventive. It's linked to all sorts of positive health effects. So very complicated thing to weigh.
It is, you know, but it's something that I tell my listeners to actually think about, you know, and maybe do a mixture, you know, of an organic white rice, like a basmati or a jasmine or something, and mix it up with the brown rice, that, you know, but also to not, you know, if you're choosing alternative milks, you know, maybe not choose a rice milk because of the arsenic. Yeah. I mean, our food issues are constantly changing too. You know, something I also talk about is, you know, food loyalty. You know, you get somebody hooked to a product early on, even an organic product, and then it's bought out by a big conglomerate, and then the ingredients change, but you don't notice it, you know, because you're already loyal to that product and you just keep buying it. And so I always tell people you have to keep looking at the labels because they change, right? You know, it's like it was organic last month, but this month it's not organic anymore. So
yeah, I'll add something interesting on that, which is I mentioned the really positive outcome in Chile of their front of package warning disclosures, high in sugar, high in sodium. but they are seeing some sort of unexpected, unintended effects of the policy, which is what are they replacing the sugar with when the food industry decreases sugar in the food supply? And they're replacing it with artificial sweeteners to some extent. So we're seeing an increase in the presence of artificial sweeteners in the food supply. And so, if there's a silver lining to the U.S. lagging behind in terms of food labeling, it's that we can learn from that experience. So something else that the Food Labeling Modernization Act includes is that in addition to disclosing high levels of sugar, salt, and saturated fat, if a product contains an artificial sweetener, it'll also have to very clearly disclose which sweetener is present in the food, which will hopefully, along with education of consumers on which sweeteners are safer and less safe or less tested, will help people, again, just be able to make informed decisions.
Yeah. That makes me think about the soda act that people were trying to push through the soda law, where they were going to make, or tax sugary sodas, but they were not going to tax diet sodas. And that infuriated me because it was going to push people who are really tight financially to abort buying sugary soda and instead buy artificially sweetened soda, which I think is even worse for them. So everything's so confusing when it comes to the food issues. And that's why so many people are really pushing and trying to just encourage people to eat real food, not packaged food. That's our best bet, is really to obviously buy the whole grains and then cook them up yourself. Buy the fresh vegetables and cook them up yourself and make your food so you know what's in it. I know when I make bread, there's very few ingredients. There's flour, water, maybe an oil, maybe a little salt. That's it. And when you look at the ingredients of bread with all the malt dextrose and the dough conditioners and all this stuff, you think, why? Why do they need to put all that in there? It's very confusing. What about the label natural? That's come up so much in the news. I mean, natural really means nothing, right? So how's that going to be addressed?
Sure. So indeed, natural is among our most commonly used and most ill-defined terms that we see on food labels. And the label really tells you nothing from a health and ingredient perspective or an environmental impact perspective, really nothing to do with how the food was produced. And we're particularly concerned as a consumer advocacy group with how confused people are about what natural means and how much they assume about what it means that's untrue. So there's been some polling done by the group Consumer Reports that finds that many people think that natural means something about what pesticides are used on on crops that go into a packaged food product. They think it means something about the presence of GMOs, about processing aids. And there's also polling that's shown that more people seek out foods labeled natural than foods labeled organic. And that's, really a shame for the organic food industry to have this competition from products that are not equivalent in terms of their production practices. So what the food labeling modernization does, it makes it a little harder to use the natural label on your food, because if you use the term natural as an industry, then you also need to have a disclosure explaining what the term natural means. So the bill actually doesn't weigh in on what it should mean, except in a couple of respects having to do with it can't have artificial flavors or artificial colors. But beyond that, we sort of kick it to FDA to define the word natural, however they decide. It almost doesn't matter at this point because nobody knows what it doesn't mean anything. They can write it from scratch, but then people need to be educated about what it means. So if you're going to use it on your label, you need to also have the disclosure explaining exactly what it means. And that will be part of sort of an education campaign to reset, you know, everybody's perceptions about this term that's so common and so misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. That would be great. that would be great. How long does it usually take for a piece of legislation like this to get passed? And how is it looking in Congress right now?
Oh, well, nothing's looking great in Congress right now.
That's true.
But so it's interesting. The Food Labeling Modernization Act, as it's currently written, has a ton of different provisions, a ton of different changes to the food label in it. And, you know, as an organization, the Center for Science and the Public Interest thinks that all of them are very important and will very much improve the food label. But there are pieces, there are aspects of the bill that are widely supported, we think could garner bipartisan support pretty easily. And then there are, you know, more controversial ones that the food industry or certain groups within the food industry might lobby against harder than others. And something that's happened in the past with this bill, because it's actually the fourth time the bill has been introduced in Congress, although it's evolved over time. In the past, something that's been done is if a particular provision of the bill has very widespread support. So I'll give an example. Then it's pulled out into its own separate piece of legislation, and that can be passed separately. So this happened with the FASTER Act just this year, earlier this year. And the FASTER Act, I can't tell you off the top of my head exactly what that acronym stands for, but it was a bill that established sesame as the ninth major food allergen. And it was based on accumulating evidence that people were having very serious reactions to sesame, similar to how people have life-threatening reactions to peanut. And it's the ninth most prevalent, but I think the third, or I forget exactly, but one of the top most severe food allergies. And so the bill included this, the Food Labeling Modernization Act included this provision that would establish sesame as a major allergen, requiring that it be labeled as an allergen on all foods. And that was pulled out and passed with bipartisan support. And so it's no longer in the bill because it's already in place. But there are other pieces of the bill as it currently stands that we think might be able to garner bipartisan support and pass on their own if the bill as a whole doesn't move forward as quickly as we wish.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I hadn't heard that sesame was that high in allergen. You know, I cook for a lot of people that have food allergies, and sesame usually is not one of the ones that comes up very often with my clients. So that's interesting. What about gluten? You're right. So many people seem to have an allergy towards gluten these days. Will this Food Labeling Act help people to know if there's gluten in the product?
Yes. So, and this is actually one of the provisions that, similar to the sesame, we think could really move, and we might see a standalone bill in the future on this. But the sesame provision, I mean, sorry, the gluten containing grain labeling provision of the Food Labeling Modernization Act, similar to the sesame provision, would add gluten containing grains to the list of ingredients that have to be disclosed in the same way as allergens. So you often see a contain statement on a product. It says, you know, contains peanuts, shellfish, and eggs. I don't know what product that is, but so it would have to say, so wheat is already one of the top major allergens but barley and rye are not. And wheat, barley, and rye are the three gluten-containing grains. And that's something very much known by people with celiac disease. And that's sort of the highest risk group for people who have negative effects from consuming gluten. And so what the bill would do is add barley and rye to the list of ingredients that have to be disclosed as in the contained statement.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really interesting to me that they are not requiring on in any of the labeling any of the pesticides used, because, you know, so many people believe that the gluten sensitivity that the population is experiencing really is more on the glyphosate that they spray the gluten, that they spray the wheat with when they harvest it to help it dry quicker. And that is really what so many people are having a reaction to, as opposed to the actual gluten itself. Is any of that being addressed in this bill?
Yeah, I'm not all that familiar with the science around pesticide exposures, and the bill doesn't include anything about pesticides, except to the extent that it deals with confusion around the term natural, which oftentimes people think means no pesticides.
No pesticides, uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, the gluten-containing grain provision, it's interesting. So people seek out foods that are gluten-free, and the FDA did, you know, put resources into putting out a ruling a few years ago around what gluten-free means and around allowing companies to make gluten-free claims. But really, gluten-free has become a marketing claim, right, just like low fat, just like natural. And those products often have a price premium to them, but people with celiac disease, you know, they're not choosing to eat a gluten-free diet. They have to. And it's pretty unfair to them if they have to only purchase this more expensive gluten-free food. And so what requiring the disclosure of gluten-containing grains does is makes it really about affirmative disclosure of the presence instead of just marketing the absence of gluten. And that's something that we feel is really important from a health perspective.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, of course. And what about products like toddler beverages? I think you had mentioned that the new labeling law will address that as well. How will it affect toddler beverages? And what do we really mean by toddler beverages?
Sure. Yeah. First, I'll explain what toddler beverages are. If you haven't heard of these, that's a good sign, because nobody should be feeding toddler beverages to their toddlers. That's something that we believe, based on the evidence, the American Academy of Pediatrics and even the dietary guidelines for Americans have said the same, that they're not necessary for toddlers. So what this is the infant formula industry seeking out new opportunities for selling more formula and formula-like products and trying to expand to a older children, to an older age group. And so they've created this product category called toddler milks or toddler beverages, but they are essentially sugar-sweetened beverages for toddlers. And that's particularly problematic given that children under the age of 2 are supposed to avoid added sugars entirely in their diets. That's according to, again, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. So we're really concerned that there are these products that are loaded with added sugars being marketed for an age group that shouldn't have any added sugars at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just amazing, you know, how money is the driving factor in the food industry and in obviously so many industries, and the health of the public is so low on that list of importance.
Mm-hmm. And I think I should also explain how the Food Labeling Modernization Act is going to address this category of toddler beverages,
please, yeah,
and how the labeling of them will change. So there's a few issues with these toddler milks. One of them is, like I said, they have added sugars in them. And I don't even know what percentage of parents know that children under age two shouldn't have any added sugars in their diets. But what the bill will do is it will require that on these products, if they have added sugars and they're marketed for young children, they'll need to have a disclosure sort of prominently stating on the package that this product contains added sugars. But the dietary guidelines for Americans do not recommend added sugars in the diets of children under age two. So, you know, if it's too difficult legally to ban the products from even existing, at least we can, again, help parents make informed choices when they're buying products, be aware of the dietary guidelines and the fact that the product inherently violates them. And then another issue with these products is that parents might confuse them with infant formula because they are marketed with very similar imagery and similar containers. They're often powdered milk products, just like formula. And so the bill will also establish a disclosure that says do not serve to infants under 12 months. And that will hopefully prevent parents from confusing them with infant formula because they are not held to the same very, very strict standards for infant formula in terms of the nutrients that they have. And, you know, it has to be all of the nutrients an infant needs in their diet. And these toddler milks are not appropriate milk replacements. So, again, yeah, it will address sort of both of those issues with this product category.
Uh-huh. And what about beverages that are so artificially colored? Like, you know, it always makes me crazy when I see people drinking that blue Gatorade. You know, does this labeling act address artificial colorants at all?
Yes, it does. So as you might know, in Europe, they actually have a warning on lots of products with artificial colors about the link between artificial colorants and behavioral issues in children, because there's a whole large body of evidence showing that that artificial colorants can lead to hyperactivity and other behavioral outcomes in children. I don't know that we fully understand the mechanisms for that, but it's something that's been shown in even randomized controlled trials. So it's clear that there's some sort of effect happening there. And the bill doesn't go quite as far as Europe in having a disclosure regarding the health effects, but it does add a requirement that the presence of artificial colors has to be declared on the front of the package, which, again, as I've mentioned, is really the prime real estate, oftentimes the only part of the label that consumers use to make their food decisions. So hopefully it'll at least, again, help with making informed choices.
Right. But like a caramel coloring or adding, you know, a molasses to the bread to make it look whole grain, that's all still going to be allowed, correct? That's not considered artificial color.
It only deals with like the FD&C type colors.
What about educating doctors? I mean, you know, how many pediatricians recommend to their clients that they give their children Gatorade, you know, if they're doing sports? There's no addressing the medical establishment in any of these bills, is there?
You know, I'm aware that that there's a group out of Tufts University, happens to be my alma mater, that it is working hard on educating medical professionals more about nutrition. I don't know the details of the legislation they're working on and whether something's actually been introduced in Congress. But I certainly agree that's an extremely important an effort, and it's not something included in this bill, which only addresses labeling. But right. It's true, we need doctors to have better knowledge of nutrition, because that's prevention, and we can't only be treating patients by the time they already have diabetes or heart disease.
Yeah. And most doctors really don't know about it. I mean, you know, I've talked to so many doctors, and I think they get an average between 2 to 4 hours of nutrition education in their whole 4 years of medical school. Mm-hmm. 2 to 4 hours. That's it. You know, and so they don't really know. And it's shocking to me. It's shocking to me that doctors don't recommend healthy diets at all, for the most part. You know, it's a rare doctor. My internist retired this year, and I'm looking for another doctor. I'm trying to interview doctors. I loved my doctor, but it was not like she was so remarkable. It was that she believed in food as medicine, and she believed in exercise and meditation all before medication, you know? And those are three things that I think all doctors should recommend: your diet, your exercise, you know, meditation of some sort to stay calm and release stress, and then medicine. And, you know, they just go right to the pills. And it's just, it's really a problem. And I think we've seen it so much with this virus. We really need to be pushing healthier eating. And so I want to just thank you for your work. You know, the Center for Science and Public Interest is, like you said, you've been around for 50 years, not you, but this is the organization. And, and they're really working to, you know, protect us. And so we need more organizations like that. And I just want to thank you for your work. It's really so important. Lastly, we're almost out of time, but can you just share with my listeners any ways that they can get involved and advocate for helping to pass the Food Labeling Modernization Act?
Absolutely. So the best way to advocate for the Food Labeling Modernization Act is to write to your representatives and your senators, urging them to support the bill. And you can do this by visiting our website, which is cspinet.org. That's cspinet.org. And if you go to our Take Action page, you can find our action alert, which makes it really easy for you to write to your representatives about the FLMA. So thank you so much, Bhavani. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. And everyone out there, I want to wish everyone a really happy, happy holiday season, whether you celebrate Christmas, Kwanzaa, whether you celebrated Hanukkah earlier in the month. We all celebrate the new year. And so I wish everybody a really happy, stress-free holiday season. And I will not be with you next week, but I will return at the beginning of January. So have a great week. And enjoy the holiday. And Eva, thank you so much for joining me. And everyone out there, have a great week. Bye for now.